This is Audible.
Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs.
Be obsessed or be average. My name's Grant Cardone, and I'll be reading this book to you today, as well as ad-libbing, adding, and colorifying the delivery of this book. I hope you enjoy it. Really appreciate you purchasing the audio. And if you have any questions, you can always email me, gc@grantcardone.com, gc@grantcardone.com. This book is dedicated to my wife, Elena Lyons Cardone. For over 20 years, I was obsessed with finding the perfect woman for me. Tremendous amount of pain tied up in trying to find this perfect, perfect woman for me. The call was so powerful. When I met her, when I first met her, the call was so powerful that I sold where I lived. I sold the house I lived at in La Jolla, California, where I lived like a prince and a king. Sold it, moved to Los Angeles, believing this woman was there. Keep in mind, I hadn't even met her yet. I just believed the call inside of me, this obsession, this idea that she, the woman, the perfect woman for me, the calling of my life was there. I picked up, sold my house, and moved everything to Los Angeles. My business, myself. When I first met her, by the way, which was the first night I moved to Los Angeles, I became obsessed with making this woman my wife and the mother of my future children. Though it took Elena a while to see me for who I am, 13 months. Since she has never tried to change me. For 13 years, she's inspired and encouraged me. Not once has she ever said to me, you work too much. Not once has she ever asked me for more time. Not once has she ever said to me, be someone else. Change this, change that. She truly has been the perfect woman for me. She's an unbelievable partner, a great friend, an amazing wife, and a fantastic mother. And that's why I dedicate this book, Be Obsessed or Be Average, to my beautiful wife and great friend, Elena Lyons Cardone. I hope in your life you're able to find a mate, partner, have a friend, a spouse that supports you, that is as obsessed with your dreams as you are obsessed with your dreams, because it sure makes the whole game a lot easier. Introduction. My entire life, people have been telling me that my obsession with success was a bad thing. I've been called a work addict, compulsive, obsessive, never satisfied, out of balance, tyrannical, even impossible to work with. I was called selfish, greedy, mean to people, okay, narcissistic. Look, I've been called it all. I'm telling you, OCD, ADD, ADHD, so many D's that I started thinking I was a big D. I've been told I was too demanding and that I have unreasonable expectations for myself and for all others. I've had professionals, the so-called professionals, suggest I had diseases and labeled me ADD, ADHD, OCD, and much, much more. Friends and family told me for years, you need to chill out. I had customers telling me to chill out. I had people that I worked for, that I would produce for, that would tell me to calm down, relax, take it easy, back off, take some time off. I've had more people tell me I needed to take a vacation than I even wanted to take a vacation. Look, the reality is that no matter how much I have tried to squelch or control the obsession I've had with success, it has been the single one thing that is most responsible for my being where I am today. My obsessions, my obsession with success, my obsession with improving my life, my obsession with becoming the Grant Cardone I knew I could be, that sat inside of me has taken me from lost and broken in every way, by the way, financially, spiritually, physically, every way I was broken at the age of 25 to now owning 5 privately held companies. We do sales of almost $100 million a year here. This past year, I was named one of the top 10 most influential CEOs in the world. New York Times bestselling author of 6-7 books now. And an internationally acclaimed speaker speaking all over the world. I'm an attentive husband, a doting father of 2 beautiful little girls, Sabrina and Scarlett, who I love immensely. I'm a contributing member of society. Last year, I raised over $100 million for charities. Now, look, I'm saying all this to let you know who I am, how I think, and where I came from. I'm not bragging. Hopefully, this inspires you. This is not meant to say I'm the greatest in the world. I think you're the greatest in the world. I think all of us have greatness inside of us, and I want to inspire you in this read today to find that thing that you're obsessed with. I just want to make it perfectly clear that what I've achieved in my life is not because I am of some particular invention. I didn't go public on Wall Street. I didn't create some great app. I didn't have some spectacular breakthrough monster invention, okay? It hasn't been because of luck. It hasn't been because I was connected to the country club or the right people. It wasn't because somebody gave me a bunch of money or seeded my start. My success has come from my commitment, my willingness to embrace my obsessions, to go all in all the time, to finally put aside the labels, the negativity. Hopefully you're going to get luckier than I did. I did not get lucky, okay? There was no luck along the way, literally. There was hard work. I have not accomplished what I've accomplished because of timing, some kind of inside deal, some special intelligence, some super leverage because of Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan. I have friends that did that. That's awesome. That's great. But that is not the way that I've created what I've created. I am where I am today only because I have embraced my obsession with success. It has been very difficult. But I made it, and I want you to make it. Now, that being said, that there's been a lot of hard work and a lot of commitment to obsession, before I gave myself permission to fully own my obsessions, to fully own them, okay, to like eat them, breathe them, swim in them, and harness them, I have been denying my obsessions with success, with wealth, with notoriety, with celebrity. I had been denying that obsession, and denying those obsessions had almost killed me, literally killed me. Look, I learned the hard way that if you deny your obsessions with being successful or the right marriage or a great life or being rich or wealth or whatever your obsession is to have adventure, if you're obsessed with those things, then you need to embrace that, because if you don't completely own and embrace the obsessions, those things that you're obsessed about, which might be your purpose for being on this planet, you will become obsessed like I did with the wrong things, and that will become very destructive. I'm going to share with you my story about discovering my obsessions and how that alone has given me this unbelievable life that I have today that I refer to as a super life. I will share with you the tools I've discovered along the way to put my obsession to work for me, not against me. I want to give you permission to be completely and unapologetically obsessed. That is the goal of this book. I want to give you permission. If you walk away, say, Grant Cardone gave me permission. I am now giving myself permission to be completely and unapologetically obsessed with those things I want, regardless of who you are, where you come from, what your family is like, or what your crazy big dream is. You know, before I wrote this book, I wrote a book called The 10X Rule. It's an international phenomenal bestseller about the importance of thinking and executing at massive 10X levels. In short, if you're going to have a budget for a project, in the 10X rule I wrote, set that budget at 10 times what you initially considered. If it was $1 million, then make it 10 million. If $1 million is the amount of money you want to earn annually, then make that 10 million. If the budget was $1 million, make that $10 million, okay? If the weight loss was X, 10X that. If you wanted to do it in 10 months, reduce it into 1 month. You understand? It was a very aggressive, big thing. 10 times everything. The 10X rule was ultimately about multiplying your goals to achieve any objective. It was to go for much bigger things, not smaller things. This book became an international phenomenon because people were trying to operate in increments in their life and started thinking in terms of surges or 10X. Even Google, the great company Google, uses the 10X rule when they look at buying a company or investing their time and energy. They look for big surges of growth, not incremental growth. After I released the 10X rule, so many people wrote me saying things like, I'm trying to 10X my business and I'm having trouble staying with it. Or this 10X thing is throwing my entire life, my marriage, my kids, my balance, is throwing it into disruption. That's when I realized that there was a missing piece to the puzzle. That when I finished writing the 10X rule, I had not completed the book. I had not completed giving people everything they needed, which was, if you're going to go 10X or 100X or 1000X, you're going to have some problems. I flirted with this concept in the book. I said, look, when you start operating at the right levels of activity, the first response, the first thing that will happen to you is you will create new problems. And like any book, with that book being finished, okay, you leave some details out. And in this case, it was causing people problems because they were like, dude, I went 10X, I went 20X, I went 100X. My income exploded and my marriage fell apart. Well, I don't want that for you, okay? Look, obsession is the missing piece for the 10Xers of the world. If you've ever thought, I can do way more, but how am I? I can do 10 times more, but I don't have any time. I can do 10X or 100X more, but how do I find time for my wife and my kids? Obsession is the missing piece. The mindset, the mental, if you will, that will allow you to apply 10X rules in your life and your business and have a 10X super life, not in one area, but in all areas. Look, today my life is like this, okay? I don't think about a job. I don't think about a stream. I don't think about a TV interview. I don't think about a book. I don't think about an audio program. I think about my life. I don't think about time with the kids or time with the wife. I think about my life. I have literally been able to create a life where I get to do what I want, when I want, how I want, 365 days a year for one reason. I am obsessed with my life. And I want you to be obsessed with your life. Of course you can be successful without being obsessed. There's many people that have been super successful without being obsessed. But you and I don't know them. You don't know their names and I don't know their names, okay? They did not change the world, okay? The people that changed this planet for the better are obsessed. Sure, you can be successful without being obsessed, but you cannot reach the levels of success that I'm referring to in this book without being all in, obsessed, all the time, obsessed. No balance, completely immersed. It's a single common factor that the super successful, that is people that you and I both know, people that have changed the world, the super successful all share this one thing. It's not the color of their skin. It's not their religion. It's not their business. It's not the industry they were in. It's not how much money they made or invested. It's not how they got there, the road or the path. It is this one thing, this one ingredient. They were obsessed. People of all levels of IQs, from all parts of the world, from different socioeconomics, the one thing they had in common was obsessed. They were obsessed. They could not spit the hook, as we say in Louisiana. They could not get the hook of obsession out of their stomach. I couldn't get it out of me. I had to do this thing. And in that, they changed the world. Oh, by the way, those people also embraced their obsessions. They didn't fight it. They gave themselves permission. Now, I'm going to show you how to become obsessed and how to harness, control, manage, produce, okay, and use obsession to create electricity and energy and creativity and art. I've broken this message and guide, this book, into manageable chapters. The first chapter of Be Obsessed. Listen to this, man. B-O-B-A. The first chapter of B-O-B-A. You can always tweet me. Hashtag B-O-B-A, I'll know you're one of us, one of the crazies. The first chapter of Be Obsessed or Be Average, I'm going to explain how obsession saved my life and why it's so important. In fact, I'm going to tell you this. If you're not obsessed, I don't think you have your life yet. Listen to what I just said. So the next time a mom, a dad, a wife, a husband, your kids tell you you're obsessed, you ain't got a life if you're not obsessed. You got somebody else's life. You're not even being you yet. I define obsession and what it means to me in chapter one. In chapter two, I'm going to erase the conventional wisdom that average and safe are all you can achieve. That's what they tell you. That's what the middle class is built on. Mommy and daddy, your brothers and sisters are trying to convince you to fit in. And you know you hate it. And then you have kids of your own and you try to get them to fit in. I'm going to explain to you in chapter two why you must replace mediocrity and doubt, this middle class fit in concept, with a burning, purposeful, animal, beast-like, carnivorous obsession. Then in chapter three, by the way, that doesn't leave you ladies out. Ladies, you're being held down. You're being told to act like ladies. The glass ceiling you have given yourself is your inability to own your obsessions. In chapter 3, we'll look at how you can identify your own obsessions, how you can identify, how you can chart out what should you be obsessed with that is productive, that would actually create and change and make betterment in the world. I'll walk you through key exercises where you can use these exercises to find out what you really most want in life, the things that you burn for, that you're here for, those things that are unique to you. The next chapters build on the foundation guiding you through the tough process of beginning to follow your obsessions. Obsessions, by the way. The book publisher wants me to write obsession. Notice in the book, they always say obsession, singular. But when I wrote this book, I always wrote it as obsessions. They thought that I included the S incorrectly. Okay, I didn't. Sorry, guys over at Penguin. Okay, it's obsessions to follow your obsessions. Nobody has one obsession. That one thing that you're looking at right now is indication that you are not embracing your other obsessions. Probably one obsession would be the destructive one. It would be an indicator. You're obsessed with one thing means you haven't given your right to be obsessed with the right things. I'll prove to you in this chapter why it's important to feed the beast. To feed the beast, fuel the beast, give the beast energy. The very thing that your friends and family, that society has tried to talk you out of doing, I want to tell you, fuel it, send it electricity and energy and power. In chapter 5, we'll explore why you need to starve your doubt, how to actually starve doubt, how to use fear, how to starve the boogeyman, how to block out the naysayers, how to embrace and use haters. Haters, I love my haters so much. Man, without my haters, where would I be? How would I get where I gotta go? Because they're fuel. They're like rocket fuel to the next level. But how do I handle the more damaging people that are close to me that aren't haters, but they're naysayers and they're critics and they're judges and their opinions? You know, the old saying, everybody's got an opinion. Yeah, that's right, man. They got a lot of opinions and a lot of them aren't spoken and a lot of them hide. They're basically clothed in love. They look like love and friendship, like your mommy telling you, we love you just the way you are, little Peter. We love you just the way you are is your mother telling you, please stay the way you are. When you want to get rich or you want to be famous or you want to be known for some invention. Look, starve the doubt. We're going to talk about how to starve the doubt, how to block the naysayers, how to embrace haters and use them, how to handle family members and people close to you, maybe the person you sleep with. How do you handle them? Chapter 6, I'm going to be talking about and sharing with you ways you can learn to use your obsession to dominate in life, in the marketplace, at work, how you can handle your past, your thinking, your money, your area of expertise and your brand, how to become a celebrity in your space, how to become the go-to expert by using obsession to dominate and own the space that you live and work in. Chapter 7, I'm going to explain to you why playing it safe will be the end of you. It will be the most dangerous thing you can do. It will be more dangerous than any terrorist organization, any political organization, or any economic collapse that you can imagine. Playing average, being average, thinking average must become that thing you associate with the most likely end of you. And how and why would you want to stay dangerous in an environment that already appears dangerous? I'm going to suggest to you in this chapter, I'm going to show you why you want to be the most dangerous person in your environment and why you being dangerous will actually make you and provide you and your family, your business, your brand, your name with protection against great odds. These principles will guide you in the quest for success and I believe allow you to actually grab success and not just choke it to death, but multiply hundreds of times. Then we'll shift to practical business advice where I will help you make your obsession real, not only to you, but to everyone around you. In chapter 8, I'll share my world-renowned sales knowledge. Couldn't help but add this to my book to help you understand the importance of sales and income and promotion and branding, to realize your obsession, to actually be able to count it. See, poor Mother Teresa, man, if she would have just known what I know, she would not have had to help the whole world and not been paid. Or Van Gogh, who's created 400 pieces of art and only sold one while he was alive. Poor artists and charitable people give their heart and their soul, their blood, their sweat and their tears, and are never paid for it. In this chapter, I'm going to be sharing with you how to become a monster marketer or promoter, how to actually become a salesperson, even if you hate sales. In chapter 9, I'll focus on winning customers over and how you can overpromise and how you must overpromise and then overdeliver. The old saying, the adage is underpromise, overdeliver is such a deception. It's such small, tiny, little winky thinking. In chapter 10, we'll turn to the people you work with, especially employees and friends and neighbors, the culture that you live in. I'll show you how to build a culture of maniacs around you that are totally aligned and support you with your obsession. Where I work and where I live, people support me in being obsessed. Nobody's trying to stop me anymore, okay? The first 40 years of my life, everybody was trying to change me. Now everybody's like, dude, you're the man, dude. You're the man, man. I want to be like you. See, now I'm getting fueled. My obsessions are getting fueled, and I'll show you how to do that. We'll close chapter 11 out with advice on how to be a leader, how to be the example, how to be the beacon, how to be the lighthouse, not the tugboat. How and why you must be a control freak and why control is so important to the successful. These are practices you will need in order to not just maintain your dreams, to not just maintain, but grow your obsession into a thriving, lucrative, and powerful business that can maybe even create an entire new industry or even, oh, I love this idea, disrupt an existing one. The last two chapters of Be Obsessed or Be Average, I will talk to you about how to sustain your obsession over time. This is very, very important. In chapter 12, we look at the power of persistence as your obsession matures and morphs into something beyond what you can only imagine today. And before I let you go, change the world, in which I know you will. I believe that people will actually change the world because of this book. In chapter 13, I'm going to share with you my final tips and techniques on getting, being, and staying obsessed. Look, we've all read generic books that tell you to follow your dreams. That's not a put down on those books. But while those books might offer inspiration, and they're important, they don't tell you how to really make a permanent change in your life. This book will be brutally honest. It will tear down the cocoon of average that has been spun so tightly around you by society. It will help you unleash the power of obsession and teach you how to direct it and take care of it, to take care of your obsession like a child, to achieve your most powerful dreams, like a soldier, like military equipment, so that you can assault the things you want in your life and make your dreams a reality. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a business owner, trailblazer, free thinker, an artist, an athlete, an inventor, a salesperson, male, female, no matter your color, whether you're creative or not, introvert or extrovert or engineer or whatever you are today, I know you're someone who strives for success, who dreams big, who refuses to settle, and who knows deep down inside that you are capable of more. This book, Be Obsessed or Be Average, will encourage you and fuel that can't quit, won't quit, accelerator to the floor, monster ambition inside of you. I'll help you establish your brand and business and show you how to grow it to staggering heights. Despite all obstacles, despite the competition, despite the economy, despite the naysayers and the haters. This is because obsession is that critical component that you must embrace, that critical component of success, senior to strategy, senior to pricing, senior to timing, senior to competition, senior to all the people in your life. It offers you a method for living in true freedom and total control, absolute control of your life, personally, financially, and emotionally. When you become unapologetically obsessed, as I am, you'll be at your very best, hyper-focused, persistent, beyond understanding, creative to the point of appearing to be magical, and with insatiable determination to win that not only attracts other great people, great investors, great partners, but also brings out the best in others. This level of obsession doesn't mean you're selfish. It doesn't mean you're self-centered. It means that you're finally being you. You're finally operating at the levels of you. And until that happens, you can't fulfill your purpose. The you that was always meant to be and that can pull others around you up to their full potential because you've pulled yourself up to your full potential and your possibilities. The obsessed are the industry builders, the leaders, the disruptors, the titans, the game changers, the legends, the living legends, not just the dead legends, that others admire and wish to emulate. The obsessed don't just make the world go round, they make the world worth living in. It's my goal that this book, Be Obsessed or Be Average, will influence you and millions of others, billions of others around the world to create a new movement, a movement, B-O-B-A, where we give one another permission to embrace and fuel our obsessions and resist being average. Imagine if every person on planet Earth threw themselves fully and completely into their positive obsessions without reservation, without regret, and without apology. Overnight, this world would be a different and better place. With everyone so focused on their own production and creating their success, creating that thing that they were here to do, there'd be no time for war, drugs. There'd be no time for wasteful, unnecessary destruction. There'd be no time for criticism and judging. I wouldn't have time to stop and talk about your haircut or your makeup or your height or your car or your office or whatever. I would be obsessed with my own thing. We'd all hit levels of success that we all thought was previously impossible. And we would inspire one another to do more and be more. Look, if you're all in, if you're ready to take responsibility for your life and your business, and your marriage, and your children, and your society, and your community, and your church. If you're ready to change your own future and the world, dude, get obsessed with me. Get obsessed right now. Just make a decision. I'm no longer apologizing. I am all in, all the time. I'm obsessed. Tweet me a little note, anything that you got out of this introduction. Get excited about this book because it's going to be a game changer. Hit me, hashtag B-O-B-A, and turn the page. Can you believe that we're only on chapter one? Obsession saved my life, and I believe it will save yours. For you to understand how I became successful and how I learned about this amazing power of owning, like embracing your obsessions, I first need to show you how denying my obsessions almost ruined my life. That's right. I denied the obsessions, and it almost killed me, literally, physically killed me. It's not a pretty story, but I must tell you, it's a real story. It happened to me. It's not a story of drama or to pull heartstrings or to get you to feel connected to me. This is what happened to Grant Cardone. And I wouldn't be surprised if you find some parallels to your own life and mine. Look, the roots of my obsession, I didn't have a father who led me to the land of the rich. He didn't talk to me about becoming a millionaire. He couldn't lend me $1 million for my first real estate deal. He didn't assist me with country club connections, political connections. He didn't introduce me to the important people in the city. He never showed me the ways of business. He couldn't. See, my parents were the children of Italian immigrants who came to this country, came to America in the early 1900s. My grandfather was a shipbuilder. My other grandfather never had papers to live in America. My dad, Curtis Lewis Cardone Sr., was the first in his family to even attend college. He was an ambitious young man, I would find out later, who had the entrepreneurial spirit. He even had that millionaire, I want to be a millionaire thing going on. He believed the American dream was within his reach. Remember, this is 50 years ago. He wanted to be part of the middle class coming from poverty. He started his entrepreneurial adventure in a little grocery store with my mother. They operated it together. My dad was obsessed with one thing at that time. He was obsessed with the idea that it was his responsibility to take care of his family, that taking care of family was his first duty. From a very early age, I got that my dad's intention, I got, without him ever telling me, his number one mission in life was to provide for his family. I didn't know until later that he also had this ambition to be rich. He wanted, at the early times of his life, to put a roof over his head, his wife's head, and his kid's head, to make sure we had food, clothes, and an education. A few years before I was born, my dad took on an ambitious plan to start his own life insurance company with a couple of partners. I don't know all the details of what happened with the life insurance company, but I do know that he lost it. His partners ousted him. I imagine it wasn't very comfortable. It was probably painful. It probably hurt him a lot. And he was wounded and found himself in a very difficult, tough situation. At the age of 42, He found himself in transitions without a job, 5 kids, 3 kids in the household, 2 more on their way, one of which was me. He had to feed 3 kids. He knew his wife, my mother, was pregnant with my twin brother, Gary, and myself. And my dad was starting over at 42. Imagine, life is already difficult enough, okay? Trying to create a middle class, trying to feed 3 kids and finding out you're out of work, lost your dream, and you have 2 more kids, 4 and 5, on the way. My dad decided to use the little bit of money with my mother's inspiration and support to use the little bit of money he had in savings to become a licensed stockbroker, and he embarked yet on another career. Thanks to his work ethic and his obsession with providing for his family, that's right, an obsession to be a provider, his new venture started to pay off. He bought a new car that he was very proud of. I remember a Lincoln Town car. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, and I could see how proud my dad was. Just after my 8th birthday, we moved to a new home on a sprawling 1.5-acre lakefront property. My dad had made it. We owned a boat, as I remember it. We were fishing every day, water skiing, riding a lawnmower. My dad got a riding lawnmower, and he thought, oh, my God, I'd made it. Doctors, who at that time were the most successful people in the community, lived on both sides of us. Dr. Morin on the left side, Dr. Stevens on the right. My dad's hard work and success at the stock brokerage had gotten our family firmly into the middle class. We weren't rich by any means, but we were firmly in the middle class. I often heard my mother tell my dad, I'd hear them talking about how he had made it. Even as a young kid, I knew something special had happened in our family. The next 2 years with my family at this lakefront home, we had an amazing part of my childhood, but it didn't last long. Only 1.5 years after my dad had bought this dream house, he died of a heart attack, a heart condition at the age of 52. The truth is, he had suffered from this heart condition since the age of 42. For the 10 years that I was with my dad, he had suffered from the physical stress of a heart condition. My mother had now found herself a widow at 48 years old with 5 kids, a little bit of life insurance money, or death insurance, and a big house in the country that required constant attention. My mother had no professional skills she could use in the marketplace to bring in new income. She had dedicated her life to being a wife and a mother. That's what they did back then. And now she needed to figure out how to conserve this much money my dad had left, stretch it out as long and as far as possible to get 5 kids through school. This was a huge challenge, particularly with no idea about how to create new income, without a college degree, without education, without ever holding a job. My mother had to figure out how to make money stretch. She had grown up in a very poor, a Great Depression time. She actually stood in food lines when she was a young child, and she remembered the poverty that comes with that. She didn't want to see her family have to struggle that way. So my mom became obsessed. She became obsessed, if you will, with making sure the little bit that we had, the little bit of money that my dad had left, would be enough to get us by. She saw everything. Everything to my mother was a threat. Everything was a future expense. So what she did was quickly downsize. She went into massive conservation retreat that I talk about in 10X. The world had delivered her a blow. The provider is dead. A little bit of insurance money. No real knowledge of how far it could stretch, how long it would stretch. She immediately put my father's dream house on the market. We sold it. We were forced back into the city to a tiny brick house on a tiny lot, surrounded by other houses that all looked exactly the same. The lake was gone. There was no more boating, no more fishing, no more crabbing, no more going outside and shooting guns. I was crushed. 10 years old. I've lost my dad. I'm in grief. I'm angry. We all missed our father. My mother's terrified every day, every single day. On top of all that, my mom, I would watch her literally go from grief to fear and fear back to grief. And I could feel it. There was a constant fear around my mother, and it started to infect me. While other boys at my age were out with their dads playing sports, they were going hunting. I grew up in Louisiana where you fish and you hunt and you run and you play. It was back in the day where you could go outside and you would only come home when the street lights turned on. I was at home watching my mother day after day, week after week, month after month, worried about money, clipping coupons, focused on basic necessities, worried about how far this little bit of money could go. My mom could make pennies bleed. Her scarcity mindset was part of everything we did and became part of the way I thought. At the same time, my mom was constantly reminding me of how very, very lucky, how grateful I should be for all that I had. She would claim, "Your father got us into the middle class. We have more than most people." I would hear her say over and over, "Never take anything for granted. You have a bike. We have a car. You have school. You have clothes. You have food." Constant reminders. Trying to make sense of the fear. Trying to make sense of the grief. I tried being grateful for what we had. I tried to be appreciative, but I saw my mom scared and I couldn't do anything about it. And none of it ever sat right with me. The whole thing seemed screwed up to me. I was 10 years old. My dad was dead. The dream house was gone. Mom was living in constant fear, and I was supposed to be grateful. I wasn't grateful. I was angry. I was pissed. I didn't know it then, but this time, this moment in my life would seed what would later drive me in my life. As much as I love, admire, and appreciate my mother, then and now, for what she was willing to do, for what she sacrificed in making sure that we had clothes, she managed the money, that we had food on our plates, that we had a roof over my head, for all that, that I was grateful for. The truth is, I didn't want to live my life in the same constant state of worry that I saw my mom experience every day. At the age of 16, I vowed to my mother, "When I grow up," I told her, "when I grow up one day," like a rebellious teenager would say, "when I grow up, I'm going to get rich so that I never have to worry about money again. I will never have to worry about having enough. I want affluence and abundance and prosperity. I don't want to worry like you do every day. And when I do, mother, I'm going to help a lot of people." See, this middle class thing, I told her, if it's what I'm supposed to be grateful for, something's wrong. I think it sucks. I'm going to get mine. And as soon as I said it, I knew I sounded like a spoiled, ungrateful, disrespectful, rebellious, snot-nosed punk teenager. And I was. In many ways, I was. And I could see how my mother, her face enraged. My mother had that look on her face that every parent gets when a kid crosses the line. She was furious. She was disappointed. She was frustrated. I was embarrassed. I was introverted for a moment. I doubted that what I said was right or wrong. I felt bad. I felt guilty. Still, I felt this overwhelming sense of powerlessness that I hated. I knew I couldn't do anything to help my mother. At least I thought I couldn't help her at the time. These flare-ups became more and more common. These acts of rebellion and me more and more often saying, "I hate this life." And the truth is, I didn't hate my life. I hated not being able to help my mother. And the more I had these outbreaks, the more I knew I was both wrong and I was right. Terrible place to be, where you're wrong and you're right. I knew I should be grateful. So many other people had less than us. But I also knew, there was a truth, a seed inside of me that says, "Hey, this is crazy. Why should anyone have to live like this? Why should anyone only have enough money to get by? Why should anyone only have enough money to still have to worry?" When things would cool down between these rebellious outbreaks, I would try to explain to my mother. I would make up to her. I would hug her. I would kiss her. "I love you so much." I would try to pour admiration and love back on her and tell her, "Look, I really do appreciate everything you do for us." But what I was trying to explain to her is that not that I didn't appreciate everything she did for us, or that I was grateful for everything we had, and that I knew that other people had it worse. The reality is, I would continue to have this push-pull, right-wrong argument about scarcity and money with myself and others for years to come. Anytime I had a blow-up, my mom and later girlfriends and friends and teachers and society and strangers would always say to me, "But you have so much. You have so much more than others." I've heard this for years. People try to make sense of me not being satisfied. I never understood this response. First off, what do others have to do with my life? My mother would always talk about people in China, people in India, people in parts of the world. I didn't even know where these parts of the world were. Later in my life, people would tell me, "Your business is doing great. Why aren't you grateful?" What do these other things have to do with me? The second thing, anytime I compared myself with others who had more, who had been more successful, People who were really living the life. People who had done giant monster things. My mom, my girlfriends, my friends, even strangers, customers would always say, they'd come back with the, "Don't compare yourself to others, Grant." Look, there was no winning. No matter how I thought about it, what I said, I couldn't win. I would tell myself over and over, one day I'm going to make it big. Have you ever said that to yourself? Have you ever thought, dreamed, had this seed, this gnawing inside of you that said, one day I'm going to do something monster? I've suffered with this my entire life. But I quit telling my mom this because every time I did tell her, every time I shared with others that I was going to do something huge, they would always reach down and give me some variation of, "Grant, why can't you just be grateful for what you've done, for what you have?" And in the case of my mom, she would start telling me again how she had grown up taking care of 5 siblings with no money and not knowing where the next meal was going to come from. All that being said, she was telling me again, be grateful for what you have. But I wasn't. I wanted more. This was the cycle of my life, the constant loop aimed at talking me out of what I believed was possible, my obsessions and what I wanted. No matter how many times I tried to convince myself of my mother's logic, because I actually did. I actually tried to get on the side of my mother's story. It never added up to me. Let me get this right. My dad works his ass off, finally makes it, buys dream house, dies, leaves family terrified every time we go to the grocery store because we're worried about running out of money. That's the calculation. That's the middle class. That's a dream. That's not a dream. That's a nightmare. Hey, no thanks. I don't want any part to do with this. That's all I know. And now I feel guilty again. You see, that's the loop. Okay. I go through the rationale. I look at it sanely. I don't want any part of this. And now I feel guilty. I can't get out of this loop. Looking back, I realize I was the only one that was actually making any sense at the time. I was the only one making any sense at all about how the world actually worked. And I wouldn't know it for years to come. Obsessed with the wrong things. I was unable to do anything to remedy my mom's situation, our family situation at the time. I was young. I was 15, 16 years old. I'm frustrated. And frankly, I didn't know how to do anything. I couldn't do anything. Do you know what it feels like when you can't help someone? With too much time on my hands and no strong mentorship, no direction, no course, no dad, no father. Those are important. I became busy becoming a problematic teenager, stuck in school every day, sitting in 55-minute classes in wooden chairs that I didn't want to be in, listening to a teacher for no reason, didn't even know why I was there, except that I was forced to go. See, by the time I was in high school, I was a handful, okay? I had a big mouth. I thought different. I was very opinionated. I was extremely disruptive with tremendous amounts of energy, and I'd get kicked out of class. And to that fact, that I was always hanging around the football player's girlfriends didn't help, because now I'm getting in weekly fights with the football team. I couldn't make the team, so the quarterback beat me up. Couldn't make the team, but I could make his girlfriend. So he beats me up. So his buddy beats me up. So the linebacker beats me up. So the fullback beats me up. This goes on and on and on. There's no payoff in high school for me, except the girls. Okay? In general, I caused more trouble than my poor mother knew what to do with. By the time I graduated from high school, don't even know how I did that. I had also fallen in with the wrong crowd, drinking, smoking, experimenting with drugs. Drugs became a daily issue in my life. I started smoking weed at 16. I knew it was wrong the day I did it. And by the time I was 19, I was using anything and everything available. Short of shooting dope, literally putting a needle in my arm, short of that, I tried it all. I'm not bragging. I'm telling you where my life went, because I denied my obsessions. I developed a massive daily drug problem. I did go to college because my mother had promised my dad before he died. My dad said, make sure those boys go to college. And so I did. I felt obligated to go. I didn't want to go. I felt obligated to fulfill my mother's promise. I didn't see the point in going to college. I wasted 5 long years in college learning how to drink and learning how to do more drugs. Never paying attention to class, not taking advantage of the education there. Not going with the intention to be obsessed with connections and education, I wasted 5 years. Taking almost nothing away from college and yet maintaining grades good enough, just good enough, to get through. Eventually, I graduated with an accounting degree I had no intention of using ever in my life. I had $40,000 worth of debt from college loans. It was terrible. It wasn't a pretty picture by any means. Okay? And not only was the condition of my life terrible, the way I felt about myself was terrible. At 23, I was at least 20 pounds underweight. My complexion was gray thanks to the drugs, and I had become the black sheep of my family. Despite my earlier pronouncements of wanting to be rich, I found myself with no abilities, or at least I couldn't find them, no self-esteem, no direction, no belief in myself, no course. I managed to get a job at a car dealership. It was a dead-end job for me. It's a job I didn't want. It's the only people that would hire me was a car dealer. And then came the kicker. As a result of hanging out with the wrong people and being obsessed with the wrong things, because I was denying my real obsession, I was beaten up within an inch of my life. I'm hanging out with the wrong people. That's what happens. Okay? Hang out with the wrong people and bad things happen. Hey, look, bad things happen to good people. You know bad things are going to happen to people that are doing bad things. I spent 3 days in a hospital after almost bleeding out in my apartment. The apartment that I paid $275 a month for and was late almost every month on. It took 75 stitches in my head and my face to fix me up. Not even my mother could recognize me that night. The scars are still visible on my face today over both my eyes, my mouth, and all in the back of my head. The people who loved and believed in me the most had no idea how to help me. Hell, I didn't know how to help me. How could they? They didn't know how to talk to me. Every time they said something to me, I felt all beat up about it. I'd get all defensive. Okay, my life sucked. Even after almost being beat to death in my own home, I didn't change my ways. Every day, just so you know where I started, every day I swore to myself, I will not use drugs today. From the age of 23 to 25, every day I would wake up, I will not use drugs today, only to find myself moments later, sometimes seconds later, doing the very drugs I had promised I would not use again. In fact, nothing changed for another 2 years. I continued to use every day. It doesn't even make any sense. Just almost got killed. I have nothing. I hated everything about my life. Swore that I would quit every day. I hated my job. I hated the industry I was in. I hated my coworkers. I hated the people I hung out with in my apartment. I hated my customers. I hated the people that paid me and didn't pay me. And I hated me. The only thing I still cared about was my dog. I had a 140-pound Doberman Pinscher named Capo the Tutti Capi, whom I had for 6 years. And I was starting to neglect even my dog. I'd become a cause of concern for everyone who loved me. And a disappointment to so many who wanted to believe in me. Uncles and aunts had given up on me. I was broke and I was broken financially, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. The weekend of my 25th birthday, I went to visit my mother at her place, not far from my dumpy little apartment, again that I rented for $275 and most often was late on. I showed up at my mom's place, loaded one night, slurring my words, tongue swollen from barbiturates. My mom, exasperated, finally gives me the big ultimatum. Don't come around here anymore until you get your life together, she said. I knew I had to change. I was going to die without even getting a chance to prove to myself or to her that I could be something, that one day, as I told her when I was 16, one day I'm going to make it. I was so far from making it at 25 years old. When I told the owner where I worked at the car dealership 3 days later, I'm going to rehab. I need help for a drug problem. He suggested I try to handle the problem myself. Unbelievable. He knew I had a problem. Everybody knew I had a problem. And he says, do it yourself. It was the first time that I admitted to anyone that I couldn't. I told him, if I could quit by myself, look, man, I would have quit when I was 16. I would have stopped at least 5 years ago when it got out of hand. A few days later, with the help of a family friend, I checked myself into a rehab treatment facility. I was terrified, yet I was hopeful. 29 days later, when the insurance coverage ran out, you know, that's how they work over there at those treatment centers. When the money runs out, they say, you get to go home now. You've recovered. See, at this point, the treatment center couldn't get any more money from me. I was sent back to the world I had left. The only thing good about that treatment center was that I learned that I could go 29 days without using drugs. If you have this problem or know someone that does, have them reach out to me. I'm happy to help, okay? I would not go to a traditional rehab center today. On the way out the door, the counselor in charge of me gave me a parting shot, some advice from the good counselor. You'll never make it, he said. You're a defective person. You have an addictive personality. You have a disease you can never recover from, he said. You have no power or control over this disease or your life. And the chances of you never using drugs again are zilch to none. The most successful thing, he said, the most successful thing you can do with your life, Grant Cardone, at this point, is to just simply never use drugs again. Focus on anything else and you will use again. Focus on anything else and you will fail. Drop all your grandiose ideas of money, fame, and success. You know, you open your heart when you go to treatment. He says, drop all grandiose ideas of money, fame, success, or fortunes. Wow. What a motivational message to leave on. I had taken a big step in seeking help, and while the treatment center gave me the chance to get off drugs, that was very valuable. By no means had this place in any way, shape, or form rehabilitated me or addressed the actual reasons I had gotten into drugs in the first place. I left the place. I can't even call it a rehab. It's almost like it's not rehab. They didn't rehab me. I left the place as broken as I had been when I entered, less I'm not using drugs anymore. In fact, my uncertainty about my life and my abilities had actually grown because I was no longer under the influence. That's what they call recovery? That's recovery? I hadn't recovered. I was also acutely aware of how fragile I was for the first time in my life. I had never, ever felt this fragile. When I stepped out of the door of the treatment center, I made a personal commitment that day to never return to drugs and to use, to tap into the addictive personality that the counselor had so tried to convince me would be my downfall to rebuilding my life. Reigniting my obsession for good. Once back home in my little dump of an apartment, same place, with only my dog for company, old Capo, I sat down at my kitchen table that night with a piece of paper. In rehab, they had you write a lot about your past. But it was all about the past. It was about the damage you had done. It was about the people that you needed to apologize for and make amends to. And all the bad experiences. But I didn't want to look at the past anymore. I had done that. Now I wanted to put my attention on the future. No more of the past, I thought. I need to look into the future. I need to create the next thing in my life. I need to put my attention onto the future and off the past. Not that I needed to deny the past. I had taken a good hard look at it. I had to stop focusing on where I had been and start getting obsessed with where I was going to go, looking toward where I wanted to go, what I wanted to create. I started writing down what I wanted to do with my life. What would I do if I could do anything? I wanted to make my family proud again is one of the things I wrote. I wanted to be proud of myself again. I wanted desperately to prove to the counselor that he was wrong. Maybe that was a gift he actually gave me. I don't know. I wrote down that I wanted to clean up all the damage I had done. I wanted to become a respectful member of society. I wanted to prove to the world that I was worth something. I wanted to be successful and wealthy. I just started writing everything. I'm going to be a respectful businessman that people admire. I'm going to help others do the same. Everything just started flowing out of me. I became obsessed with my future. Everything started flowing out of me as I gave myself permission to write about the new life I would create. I wrote more about wanting to write books one day. I don't even know where that came from. I'm going to be an author, okay? About becoming a master salesperson. I was in an industry and I hated salesperson. I'm going to become a master at the very thing that I hate. I'm going to become a husband and a father. I remember what I had told my mom when I was 16 at that moment, before everything went really bad. Mom, when I grow up, I'm going to be rich one day, so I never have to worry about money again. I'll have enough money that I will never have to clip coupons. And when I do, I'm going to help a lot of people. At that moment, I realized drugs had become a problem for me, not because I was obsessed with drugs, not because I was obsessed with bad things and bad people, not because I was destructive or addictive, but because I had given up on the things I was earlier obsessed with at that early age, particularly success. You know the old saying, what you resist will persist. When I had resisted my call to greatness and suppressed my obsessions, the energy of that shoots out in all kind of weird, crazy, destructive ways. I made a decision that night that I would no longer ever again fight my desire to be successful. I would not fight my desire to be rich or wealthy. I would not fight any longer this obsession with being important, and I would help others along the way. I knew the first step in getting back on track to my success was to help me. I couldn't help anybody else until I got my own life in order. I had to rebuild my sense of self before I could ever get others to believe in me and trust me again. I didn't even believe in myself, so I had to rebuild me. But where could I start? I had no friends. My ex-girlfriend, also an addict, was now sleeping with the drug dealer. Come home to that, see how you feel. Okay? All I had was a job at the car dealership, by the way, that I hated. And even though I hated the job, I decided, rather than getting rid of the job, I decided I'm going to throw myself into this sales job 100%. I'm going to use it as my jumping off point. I'm going to commit to learning everything I can about sales. I'm going to become obsessed with sales, master sales. I'm going to literally become obsessed with the very thing I hate until I love it and I'm great at it. I'm going to become obsessed with the auto industry, and I'm going to use every second, every minute, every free moment to help others know the truth about drugs and how destructive they are. I had two missions at that time: get great at a job I hated and help other people with drug recovery. I resolved myself to take all my obsessive energy and, rather than denying it, redirect it toward rebuilding the life I wanted to create. I went to bed after writing my new life manifesto, feeling inspired, clear-headed for the first time in years. I showed up at work the next morning, an hour early, embarrassed, self-conscious, scared of what others thought of me, short on confidence, and not knowing where to start. But I showed up. The owner welcomed me back with open arms. That was great. I realized later he had probably saved my life by giving me a place to put my life back together. He saved that job for me. My first day back was awkward, but it was good. I felt out of place. I actually sold something that day. I stayed at work later than everyone else, probably just because I was scared to go home. Free time was a great threat to me because I knew when and if I got bored or didn't have something productive to do, I was at risk of returning to my old ways. 6 months later, I was still clean, and my dedication and commitment to my new manifesto and my obsession with staying clean, rebuilding my life, and creating success for myself was starting to pay off. I had become the dealership's top salesperson, not once, not twice, but every month. I was outperforming the other people who'd worked there for years, all of whom stood around scratching their heads, wondering, what's Grant's secret? They thought it was because I was no longer using drugs, but wrong, they weren't using drugs. Certainly, I couldn't have done what I was doing while on drugs, but simply not using drugs was not the secret. I knew plenty of people who had left treatment and were not winning in their careers. The secret was that instead of being obsessed with horrible habits, I allowed myself for the first time to become obsessed with success again, with the same innocence and energy that I had as a child. Rather than denying my obsession with success, I was finally giving myself permission to embrace it, to feed it, to fuel it. I was starting to get a taste, just a taste of how life could be. I was making money for the first time in my life, and I was saving all of it because I didn't have any bad habits. More important, for the first time in my life, in years, I had felt good about myself again. My self-esteem was starting to return. I was starting to find swag in my walk, pep in my step. I was starting to believe in myself again for the first time in a long time. Though I was a long way from the kind of success I dreamed of, I finally knew I was headed in the right direction. For the first time, I was doing what I had said I would do. I would wake up in my little apartment, feed Capo, shower, watch a sales training video every morning while I ate breakfast. On my drive to work each day, I'd listen to self-improvement and sales training tapes with the commitment to become the best of the best in the industry I worked in. And in the first year, I probably spent 700 hours just improving myself as a salesperson. I arrived an hour early before everyone else, and many nights I was there till 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, sometimes midnight. When I wasn't working in the dealership, I was trying to help other drug addicts. Every month, I was better than I'd been the month before. I was selling more, I was making more money, I was saving more money, and most importantly, I was rebuilding my life and rebuilding my self-esteem. And every month that I was one more month removed from the past was one more month closer to where I wanted to go. Months added up to years, and by the time I turned 28, I was no longer the kid with the drug problem anymore. I was a solid sales professional in the top 1% of all salespeople in an industry that I just previously hated. I was starting to think bigger now. I was entertaining grandiose ideas of one day not just being a car salesman, but becoming a sales legend like the guys I was studying. I was starting to dream about ideas of one day writing books about sales, doing programs on sales. Again, this is just